Welcome to Humanities Viewpoints, a podcast from the Humanities Institute at Wake Forest University. I'm your host, Assistant Director Amy Meppam. My guests for this episode are Professor John Curley and Professor Leanne Hallberg. They have both led the Wake Forest University Art Acquisitions Trip, in which a group of six Wake Forest students purchase art from New York galleries to add to the Student Union collection. Our conversation will touch on a number of topics related to this trip, including the history of the trip itself and how students prepare for it, the role of art in public spaces, what it means to build a collection, and how art can capture and reflect the culture and political concerns of a particular time and place. The exhibition from the most recent trip, Ex Post Global, New Acquisitions to the WFU Student Union Collection of Contemporary Art, is currently on view through October 15th at the Charlotte and Philip Haynes Art Gallery on the Wake Forest Rinalda campus. For more information, visit hainesgallery.wfu.edu. John Curley is Associate Professor of Modern and Contemporary Art in the Department of Art, where he teaches courses in 20th and 21st century art, as well as the history of photography. His research explores the ways that post-war art, primarily in the United States and Europe, intervenes into larger realms of visuality, the mass media, and politics, especially during the period of the Cold War. These concerns are addressed in his award-winning first book, A Conspiracy of Images, Andy Warhol, Gerhard Richter, and the Art of the Cold War, Yale University Press, 2013. He has also published numerous essays and journals in international exhibition catalogs. His current book project, Art and the Global Cold War, A History, is under contract with Lawrence King and should appear in 2018. His research has been supported by the Getty Research Institute, the Yale Center for British Art, the Henry Moore Institute, and the Terra Foundation, among others. At Wake Forest, he received a Teaching Innovation Award in 2012 and co-led the art buying trips in 2009 and 2013. Leanne Hallberg was born in New Haven, Connecticut. She received her BA, magna cum laude, from Mount Union College in 1978 and her MFA from University of Colorado, Boulder in 1989. Hallberg has exhibited at the Southeastern Center for Contemporary Art, Rinalda House Museum of American Art, Verge Art Fair New York, the Museo Archeologico Nazionale, Ferrara, Italy, Museo Civico Archeologico Stellata, Italy, Plymouth Rock Gallery in Zurich, Switzerland, and Unterhammer in Karlstadt, Germany, among other venues. Hallberg is a teaching professor at Wake Forest University, where she has been a Hoke Family Fellow and awarded numerous grants. I hope you enjoy our conversation.
Thank you both for being here today. I really appreciate it. I'd love if you could give me a little bit of the history of the Wake Forest Art Acquisitions Trip. Sort of talk a little bit about the philosophy behind it, maybe its pedagogical aims, mm-hmm. and what some of the guiding principles are for students who participate in the program.
Sure. Well, in 1963, the dean of men, I'm not sure if there's a dean of women at that point, but Mark Rees, he came up with this idea, and he and then Professor Ed Wilson, mm-hmm. you know, Mr. Wake Forest, and Alvin Easley drove from Winston-Salem to New York to buy works of art mm-hmm. With university money, with students, and the students, of course, chose the works. And I guess I always thought of this trip as making a virtue out of a limitation. Winston-Salem, for all of its gifts, does not have a history of art collecting mm-hmm. here. And so for students, universities, it's important, art students as well as art history students and the university more broadly. Ed Wilson and Mark Rees and others recognize the importance of teaching and learning from works of art. Okay. And so because there was little art available for study here, they brought the art to Wake Forest.
Interestingly, they also intended to bring to the attention of faculty and the administration there was no even art department at True. That time. Okay. And part yeah. of their goal was to bring attention so that maybe we could have an art mm-hmm. department.
Right. It's also important to remember that Barbara Milhouse didn't start collecting for Rinalda House until the late 60s. Mm-hmm. And of course, that didn't become a museum available to students till later. And so it was a very different landscape yeah. in Winston-Salem at Wake Forest at the time. So I think it was an important way for students and faculty to recognize the importance of art to campus and mm-hmm. a way to actually do something about it.
Right. So what kinds of preparation do the students receive and engage with before the trip? Are there particular kinds of grounding in art history or a critical framework that they possess before going on the trip?
Yes, all students have to be enrolled in this course in the fall. So the art acquisition trip takes place in the spring. So in the fall, all students who are applying have to take this course. So you get anywhere between 15 and 20 applicants. Mm-hmm. And you choose, in the past, we've chosen anywhere from 5 to 7 mm-hmm. students. So in this class is a history, it's post-war art. Mm-hmm. The next buy-in trip will be more, the pre-course will be more of a contemporary art course that mm-hmm. starts in 1990. But generally speaking, in the past, it's history of American and European art, and with some other qualifiers to that, from 1945 to the present. And so investigating, you know, of course, the heavy hitters like Abstract Expressionism with Pollock, and then pop art with Warhol and others, as well as, you know, 80s and 90s artists, to kind of give those students a vocabulary to understand, you know, what is appropriation, what is pop art, what is abstraction, why do artists paint in certain ways, to kind of give them that vocabulary to be able to look at work of contemporary art and understand its references, understanding how those marks or strategies have come to have meaning in the art world and political world.
And then about halfway through the fall semester, as they're in this course, they apply to become part of the acquisitions trip, and they first have a written form that they'll fill out to apply, and then they're interviewed for the trip. And once selected, we have in the past met once a week for, well, this last trip, beginning in the spring semester, during that trip, we were meeting Friday beginning at 4 and went to as long as 8 o'clock nights, and just talking about what's happening in the New York art world and elsewhere. When the trip first started, it was pretty much centered just in New York, and things have gotten much more open and global, so lots are happening with art fairs and other places. So once they're selected, it's not just about history, but also very contemporary goings-on in the art world.
Yeah, and they're given one prompt, generally speaking, which is like the art should reflect their times. And of course, that can be interpreted in many, many different ways, reflect the times of the students on campus, reflect larger historical and political happenings, whether it's, you know, the age of Trump or Black Lives Matter or all these issues that have, of course, been front and center the last few months. But so, you know, to reflect the times, the students can kind of take that sort of very general prompt and kind of interpret it as they see fit.
And then, of course, the other thing that comes up with that is, all right, you're going to purchase works that are part of a collection. How are these works going to relate to the collection? How will they add value and meaning to the collection? What does it mean to collect art? What are the priorities and importance of that?
And, of course, it's a very difficult task for these students, being trusted with a significant amount of UNRC money.
Right.
And the students, you know, that I've worked with and Leanne's worked with in the past have always felt sort of this enormous responsibility. Like, what if they get it wrong?
Right, yeah.
You know, what if they bring back works that, you know, aren't that important 30 to 40 to 50 years? And of course, there are many such works, you know, around the university that are not quote unquote important in sort of the monetary sense or the ways that museums recognize value. But I think even in those, what we call less financially valuable works, there's a lot of lessons to be learned educationally, like why students thought this white abstract painting from 1963, you know, was representative of their times in 1965. And so I think there's some really interesting questions. And I'll say one other thing that's kind of I always thought was really interesting about this trip, and that is, you know, contemporary art history is an oxymoron. Because, of course, this is art that's happening right now.
Right.
We have no historical distance to understand what is good or what it's going to be canonized or important art. And so the students are really trying to wrestle with, in some ways, canon formation, like figure out what they think is the important art of the generation. And I always kind of like it to talk to students about this. I always kind of talk about like those mixtapes or mix CDs you make 10, 15 years ago. You pull out like, why did I think this song was good?
Yeah. You know?
And in some ways, it's maybe not a very effective metaphor, but I think it's interesting in that in the moment, it's hard to figure out when history sorts itself out, what works are going to like be left standing.
In this last trip, it was really interesting because in selecting students, we were really trying to remember that it was the student union collection, not just art people. And so I think we did a really interesting job of getting students from, you know, a pretty wide range of interests. But the funny part in trying to decide what work was important is that we had one particular business and art double major. Mm-hmm. And in trying to select the best work, he, of course, was seriously considering financial value. And so there was a lot of interesting discussion between him and others who were more concerned with aesthetics and other considerations.
Could you talk a little bit more about that sort of fraught relationship between the financial and the...
Yes, I think art has ventured into the sort of popular culture realm with people like Jeff Koons and Damien Hirst, And so much of the discussion in that arena is about money and value and fame and all of that. And I would say that in discussing it with the students, what we come to, and even the business student came to this, is that there's just an overemphasis in the general culture on money and business, and value comes can come from other things besides money.
It's true. I mean, I think it's, you know, I think, you know, back in the, was it 1939, Clement Greenberg, the great art critic, American art critic, once, you know, once said, like, said the avant-garde, or, you know, really advanced art is connected to money, you know, connected to the people through an umbilical cord of gold, you know. And so, like, you know, artists need money. They need to eat. They need, you know, they need to pay rent, you know, and these sort of things. So it's not so much to fault artists for doing commissions for Goldman Sachs, like Julia Meritu or other artists, you know, who do some sort of things, or Jeff Koons selling works for, you know, millions of dollars that are kind
people
of...
People want to be silly enough to buy a Jeff Koons, go right
you know, but there, you know, there are sort of ways to sort of think critically about that, right. About that relationship. And, you know, I think, you know, and one could argue that Koons is maybe mocking the collectors, you know, by making these really...
And all the way to the bank, he's
by making a, literally a giant lump of Play-Doh but out of these beautiful, you know, stainless, shiny stainless steel. It took him 12 years to realize. It sold for like $50 million or something like that. You know, but it is just a sort of a silly, childish work of art, right. That he's made into this sort of monument to playfulness.
The field of art is, well, it's replicating what's happening in the larger culture, mm-hmm. in this bifurcation, yeah. the haves and the have-nots. Mm-hmm. There almost is, in terms of artists, there almost is no more middle ground. Mm-hmm. You know, there are hobbyists in places everywhere, and there are the people who make lots of money, you know, like a Damien Hirst, but mm-hmm. the middle basically has dropped out.
Yeah, I mean, it's also interesting. I was at the, took some students to the Venice Biennale, and I guess two and a half years ago, the 2015 Biennale. And, you know, so I'd never been to the Biennale before, and it's always a place where collectors come and sort of figure out what's sort of hot in the art world. A lot of unofficial, nothing's for sale, a lot of unofficial deals go on, but they're like 10 to 20 giant yachts parked on the Grand Canal. And the 2015 Biennale was all about global capitalism and its sort of problems and its inequities. And, you know, the curator's really interested in probing problems, you know, of globalization. Mm-hmm. And, you know, one of the prize winners for that particular Biennale was a filmmaker who made a kind of a documentary film, basically, of sort of labor movements, you know, in South Korea. Mm-hmm. How, you know, people working for Samsung or whatever are treated horribly and these sort of things. And that won a prize, and, like, you know, then these giant yachts parked right, along the Grand Canal. And so these contradictions have always plagued contemporary art, but I think the contradictions become, you know, so stark as Leanne, so the bottom has dropped out, and now it's sort of the mega rich collecting the sort of mega wealthy artists, and everyone else sort of trying to find some way in to critique, but also to, you know, make a living. And one other quick thing to mention about, I think Leanne brought up the idea of, like, collection. What is a collection? Right. And these students also have to think about where these works are going to go on campus, because, as we all know, there's Rinalda House, which is affiliated with Wake Forest. There is no Wake Forest University Art Museum. Right. And so there are some works in Rinalda Hall, where we're sitting presently. There are works in Benson. There are works at the admissions office. And so it also kind of limits the students in thinking, you know, sculpture is a little harder to place and situate. Works that are made of any sort of delicate materials that, you know, wouldn't stand to be touched, or, you know, or the wind, or, you know, window is left open in Benson. So I think there are also considerations, very practical considerations, about where this work is cited and how is it going to survive in a very bustling and, you know, sort of, you know, not contemplative universe.
Can't really have an installation in Benson as people are walking
by. Not really. Yeah.
Thinking about where the art is going to be viewed and where it's going to be placed, maybe we can move into a more broad area of what you think as an art historian and as a studio artist. How do you see the importance of art in the community, specifically at Wake Forest?
Well, I guess from a studio perspective, I think of making art as part of the liberal arts. In other mm-hmm. words, in making studio art, I am thinking about ways of trying to understand the world. And it's just a slightly different way than everybody else around here. But I think it's really important because it's experiential. It helps us process experience mm-hmm. and understand the world in a different way. And I think those multiple perspectives are very important to learning.
Yeah, and sort of along those lines, too, I think arts speaks a very strange language. You know, it's not, you know, not mathematics, it's not science. Number one, it's, you know, it's a picture, generally speaking. You know, art takes many forms these days, but a lot of art is, you know, an image, whether it be a painting, a photograph, or some sort of sculpture. And of course, you know, these images are strange things. It might seem to say one thing, but actually, in a very subtle way, is like argue for something different. So I guess I always tell students that images are very good at housing contradictions, which are important to critical thinking. And also, you know, we're in a totally media-saturated environment. Of course, this has been the case for many years, but especially now with social media and, you know, Instagram and, you know, Twitter, all these sort of ways that people disseminate images and text. And I think, you know, we just sort of pass over images so quickly, and especially college students are, you know, immersed in this sort of image culture. And, you know, I think art allows, training in art or art history allows for people to kind of almost hit pause and think about images and think about how these images, be them an advertisement or a painting, sort of work on us. Mm-hmm. I've always thought that it's kind of like the equivalent of going fishing. You know, you're kind of doing something or you're not doing something, but that sort of action of taking a moment outside of our sort of utilitarian lives allows for that some real moments of, you know, maybe not inspiration, real moments of critical engagement and thinking. Kant always talked about the ways that step outside of the utilitarian is when real creative thought can happen. And I, you know, really do think there's a different kind of thinking that happens when looking at a work of art.
Do you think the students on the trip were able to reach that kind of moment of reflection?
Absolutely.
Yeah.
This last trip, we were at a gallery. Gosh, I can't remember. I think it was Gladstone. And looking at a room full of Sharinda shots that had been hung for us. And the students actually, jaws dropped. I saw tears. Mm-hmm. I saw tears. And no one spoke for a while. Mm-hmm. It's really amazing.
Yeah, I mean, it's also in terms of, you know, bring the history back into it as well. Like, I think, you know, I mentioned, you know, ideas of sort of contradiction, but, you know, I think one of the famous paintings in the collection is the Robert Colescott. Mm-hmm. What is the title of the painting?
Death of a Poet.
Yes. Mm-hmm. It's sort of a neo-expressionistic work, a lot of figures, sort of a crowded space, and I guess, you know, the work at some point in the 90s was vandalized. Mm-hmm. It was painted in 1989, but sometime in the 1990s, the work was vandalized. A student had to like take a ladder, like a step ladder, and like take a black permanent marker, and it's an interracial couple in bed, and this presumably a student, but could be anyone in the community, colored the, you know, the white woman with the black permanent marker to not make it an interracial relationship. But anyway, so but Robert Colescott came down and like, you know, made it kind of as a teaching moment, restored the painting and these sort of things. But I think, you know, we think about a work of art as just sort of like something that sits on the wall and sort of decorates Benson in some ways, but I think this story speaks to the power of that work in many ways, that the student was motivated to vandalize or deface the work, but also how, you know, I think it shows, you know, the artist coming down and making this a real moment of reflection and thinking what sort of values does this university embrace, mm-hmm. and, you know, a corrective, I don't know. But it's just sort of a, you know, one of those moments where people always talk about this collection, the Robert Colescott, that moment when it was defaced. Mm-hmm.
In your experience, your teaching and scholarship, how does knowledge of a particular time period's work of art provide insight into that time and place's cultural and political concerns? I mean, this is a huge question.
I should let the art historian do this, but it's so interesting, too, because it's everything. It's subject matter, or maybe not subject matter, mm-hmm. how it's created, where it's displayed. Is it part of the market system, or has it decided, you know, the artist decided not to make it part of the market. You can go on from there, but I mean, it's huge to be able to look at the time that something was made, how it was made, subject matter, history at the time, what was going on. Yeah.
So, you know, I want to bring back to the collection here. I mean, what I always was fascinated when I first came to Wake Forest and looking at this sort of catalog of all the works. And one sort of chapter, one trip is much longer than the others. That's 1969. You know, they brought home, I think, 17 or 18 works from that trip. So they just, you know, they kind of said not to spend a lot of money on one work, but buy lots of smaller, you know, less expensive works. And you think about those students, they were selected in 1968, so in the fall, so that, you know, August 68, you know, Robert Kennedy's assassinated, you know, that month too, we have, you know, mass protests in Chicago, of course, May 68 in Europe, you know, so the world is kind of exploding in 1968. Yes. So they're, you know, going on the trip in 69 and bring back huge diverse collection of work, you know, Jasper Johns, which is, you know, an American flag that's sort of you look at it, it's in sort of a orange and black. You stare at it, it kind of turns into, it leaves a white, red and white after image in your head. There's more abstract pictures. There's sort of more figurative works. Mm-hmm. And it's almost like they didn't know what the world was going to be tomorrow. Yeah. You know, and they're kind of trying to kind of cover all of their bases to figure out, you know, what's going to happen next. Yeah. And so they probably, you know, they didn't intend that. Mm-hmm. But like, you know, you kind of just, you know, their mindset in that moment, you can look at their selections and their choices and begin to understand like what it must have been, or kind of begin to understand what it must have been like to be a student,
right,
you know, in 1969.
Yeah.
So, you know, of course, as Leanne says, subject matter is another way that, you know, artists can depict the times. But I think these sort of, this collection is really interesting to think about how the students saw themselves in this sort of larger American / globalized world.
Do you have a favorite from the collection?
I got lots of favorites.
What is one of your favorites?
Right, yeah.
Ida Applebrug, the Dohosa, Julie Heffernan. Julie Heffernan is the greatest teaching tool, especially for slow kind of looking, because from a distance, it looks like a Dutch still life. And as you get closer, it reveals itself to be being much more than that. Plus, its title is Self-Portrait as Explosion, and it looks like a Dutch still life. So that, in and of itself, generates so much discussion. It's fabulous.
Yeah.
The Helen Frankenthaler is a sort of small, beautiful watercolor or gouache that sort of speaks to her larger, you know, more sort of monumental works, but, you know, but it's much more intimate and really lovely and great to teach from, to show students like how paint behaves on paper, you know, sort of a masterclass.
And the shapes and their interaction, it's wonderful.
Yeah, I mean, also, I guess, you know, maybe it's because, you know, we had direct relationship to these works. I mean, I think the Christian Marclay, which, you know, usually hangs in Benson in a very prominent place, with its references back to Jackson Pollock and other abstract artists, but its use of antiquated technologies to students, cassette tapes, you know, I think it's kind of an interesting work. So that's one of my favorites. But like Leanne, they're all wonderful things to have around.
They're amazing. I mean, Fairfield Porter. It goes on to Larry Pittman, another great teaching one.
And also, you know, I think one of the challenges, but also interesting things about the collection is, you know, where it's housed in Benson. And, you know, you could be having a Chick-fil-A or sandwich or a Moe's burrito.
Right, yeah.
You leave the food court and you're like, wow, there's a Thomas Struth photograph.
But this brings up the problem, which is that most students do not recognize this as anything more than decoration. And so that's something that we're working on.
Kind of, you think about I just thought of this now, the origins of the trip, 1963. So it is kind of a very pop mindset. Let's buy art and put it into, you know, I guess they didn't even have Benson back then, but the idea to put art next to a Chick-fil-A is kind of we're holy in its approach. And I think it does get lost to a lot of students. And there's some condition, of course, issues by having works unsecured in this environment. But I think, you know, there are some assets to that, this idea of surprise. It's the select students who see things and like, wow, what is that? I want to know more about that.
Yeah.
But, you know, it would be nice to have a white room somewhere where we can look at the works in a little more quiet atmosphere.
Yeah. And having the chairs facing the work as opposed to sitting down and having your back to it would be a great
thing. I mean, we're in this room and we can, it's not a very good reference for a podcast medium, but we're doing sort of the same thing. How do you make that known to students to sort of stop and look at these pieces that are in their daily environment?
Well, I think organizing the environment in a way that makes that happen is one way of doing it. So, for instance, in this room, rather than having this large surface be a table, what if it was lower and was seating, you know, so that, you know, you could turn around and actually look at the works.
Right.
I think the other thing is treating it with the respect that it's due.
Mm-hmm.
So, in other words, not having a lot of other clutter on the walls so you can concentrate. So often the works are hung, but there are posters or this or that, which really distract your attention, and it's hard to focus and think.
Yeah, I also think it's maybe awareness among faculty. I think there's hopefully in the future there'll be some sort of easier way that, you know, professors can use these works of art in the classroom in a place, maybe they can, a seminar room where the works can come and, you know, be taken off the wall and placed into an academic environment and sort of allow for that more sort of quiet space of, you know, of pedagogy. Because trying to teach in Benson, say, at the 12:15 or 12:30 hour is really not possible.
Sure.
Or you crowd into a, you know, a dark hallway and try to look at a work of art with 15 seminar students, and that's also very difficult.
Mm-hmm. Or like, yeah. It's just inappropriate to the work. We have a Jennifer Bartlett that it's really about perception, and it's a fairly large work in three panels, mm-hmm. and you got to get maybe two hallways away to
right.
actually be able to understand it.
Mm-hmm.
So the way it's had to be hung thus far, you totally miss the point of the work.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think there are ways to, through education and through marking spaces, maybe a way to do it. Or getting more creative with, I know we have a downtown campus now. There's a area that's going to be developed, an old warehouse we can convert in the process of conversion, put some works of art in there for a few months. You know, I think there's, as Wake Forest is becoming more spread out around Winston-Salem, there might be an opportunity to rethink how we teach from these objects.
Have there been exhibits of the select works from that collection, say at Ains Gallery?
There have been a few. So every fall after the buying trip, you, generally speaking, there's a collection show of the new acquisitions and sometimes with some other works from the collection. Mm-hmm. It was now, 7 or 8 years ago? Myself with Allison Slaby at Ronald House did sort of a retrospective of the collection, and so, you know, in their Babcock wing, which looked really nice. Mm-hmm. And then more recently, Leanne helped instigate the showing of the works at SICA.
Right. It was just a nice collaboration between SICA and the university, and they did a beautiful job of hanging the show. We couldn't show all of the collection, but a lot of the collection was up and looked really, really beautiful.
Yeah. It really showed how, when it's in a venue like that, you realize how great a collection it is. Because, you know, when it's among posters and, you know, Moe's burrito signs,
sure.
it is sometimes hard to,
chair
you know,
rail.
It's hard for a Frankenthaler to kind of compete in that environment.
Sure. And it's nice, too, to have partners like SICA, so those works are available for you from the community,
absolutely.
Too. So.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
That was Professors Curley and Hallberg on the Wake Forest Art Acquisitions Trip. Don't miss the exhibit Ex Post Global, New Acquisitions to the WFU Student Union Collection of Contemporary Art, on view through October 15th at the Charlotte and Philip Haynes Art Gallery. You can find this and other episodes of Humanities Viewpoints at humanitiesinstitute.wfu.edu/podcast or on iTunes. Just search for Humanities Viewpoints in the podcast section. You can even leave a review. Until next time, I'm your host, Amy Mepham. Thanks for listening.